Hello, this is The Truth About Parkinson's on the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Hill, and in a research laboratory in London, I'm about to have a remarkable experience.
Of course, I have absolutely no sense of what this is going to feel like to the touch. So,
I've never touched
a human brain, as an awful lot of us lay people have not. So, it's quite heavy. It's through my plastic gloves. It feels slimy. This is the best sense I can get with the gloves on. You feel slightly emotional, actually, holding a brain, and I didn't know how I was going to react. And it felt like an enormous privilege to hold one, but it also, it made me feel slightly sad, if I'm honest. And should I be sad? This may have been someone who had a wonderful, wonderful, very long, healthy, happy life. There's nothing to suggest that this is sad, but it was unexpectedly emotional.
And having done this for 30 years, I don't think I'm any less emotional than you are. These are all individuals. They've all made that bequest. Yeah, you treat them with the same respect you would as a patient when they were alive.
Professor Steve Gentleman is Scientific Director of the Parkinson's UK Brain Bank at Imperial College London. The unit takes donated brains from people with Parkinson's and those without to be used in trials all over the world. I want to find out what research is underway to help the more than 6 million people globally who have the condition, because my dad lived with it for more than 10 years and his brother for more than 20. And there's still so much we don't know. I ask Steve about the scale of the task facing scientists more than 200 years after Dr. James Parkinson first described the condition.
We haven't really yet been able to address the underlying pathological process and slow it down or bring it to a halt. And ultimately, that's what we've got to do. Preferably, treating people before they get symptoms. So I genuinely think the more brains I can get out there into more labs around the world, the more chance we've got of sorting something out.
It's a Herculean task. We need to understand what causes Parkinson's and how it develops, get to it earlier before symptoms appear, and then find a way of slowing or even halting its progress. We'll hear more about the work of the Brain Bank later in the programme. First, Professor Ray Chowdhury, head of Parkinson's research at King's College Hospital in London, reminds us it is a global challenge.
Parkinson is likely or has already become the fastest growing neurodegenerative disorder in the world. Now, with modern treatment strategy, people with Parkinson's live a normal lifespan. Many of them will live 20, 25 years into the condition. But along with long lifespan of a person with Parkinson's, you will see the progression of this illness, which is almost inevitable. With progression comes other societal impacts. The societal impact is huge, and then comes all the medicinal costs and so on that's related to it. Now, I think we really need to address this as a global issue.
Billions of dollars have been spent on research, but there's still no cure for this progressive condition. Its motor symptoms, among them slowness, stiffness and tremor, are managed with drugs, which come with considerable side effects. As we heard in our last episode, exercise is enormously helpful and is increasingly being prescribed alongside medication. But there are many non-motor symptoms too. Loss of smell, the acting out of dreams while asleep, and depression. Clinical trials are the most expensive and lengthy part of the research process, and in the last few years, several promising new treatments have failed to show benefits. Mariette Rebane writes a regular blog about life with Parkinson's from her home in the Netherlands after being diagnosed 7 years ago. Over coffee in her kitchen, she reads me one of her posts about the frustration of being a patient waiting for better treatments.
Planet patient versus planet researcher. If you've got Parkinson's, you tend to think that all those researchers should get a blooming move on and find a cure, or an effective therapy at the very least. I trust you researchers think the same. Yet, patients are on a totally different planet to researchers. From a distance, you could be forgiven for thinking that everyone on planet patient is the same. They might vary in terms of age and gender, but they've all got Parkinson's. Similarly, you expect those on planet researchers to be the same, save too for their age and gender. But then you take a better look, up close and personal. you see that there's actually no such thing as uniform Parkinson's or uniform research. They're not all casts in the same mold. And it's not so surprising that there are dozens of Little Planet's patients and Little Planet's researcher. If you're on Planet Patient, you can do one of two things. You can wait and see what the doctor prescribes, or you can take a hop, skip and a jump to Planet Researcher. And let's not forget, researchers tend only to issue visas to Planet Researcher when they need a patient. At some point, the two planets collide. The good news is that we're all just people who all want the same thing. Only you've got a different concept of time on Planet Patient. Trials can take years and years, and by the time a new pill rolls out, your dopamine has dried up.
And if the task of finding new treatments wasn't daunting enough, there's growing awareness that Parkinson's, PD for short, may in fact be made up of multiple conditions. Dr. Simon Stott is the Deputy Director of the UK-based Cure Parkinson's Trust, which liaises with PD experts around the world.
Just by going along to a support group meeting, you can see a variety of different symptoms, a variety of different ages. 1 in 20 cases will be diagnosed under the age of 40. Some people will have tremor-dominant Parkinson's, whereas others will have rigidity. There's a variety of different symptoms. And we suspect that we're looking at a variety of different conditions, potentially being caused by a variety of different causes.
And given that, how on earth does your charity, your organisation, decide where they're going to target research?
The research is now becoming extremely targeted. If you look at all the research that's been done, 80% of it's been done in the last 20 years. It's never a good time to have Parkinson's, but it's a really exciting time in the world of Parkinson's research, simply because in that 20-year period, we have had this absolute explosion with regards to the genetics of Parkinson's. That genetics has opened up doors to the underlying biology of the condition. It's associated with aging, and as the population gets older, it's only going to become more and more of a burden. And so I think there is greater awareness from society that we need to face up to these challenges.
Professor Ray Chowdhury agrees that is fundamental.
I think the real challenge for us now, in terms of diagnosis, is to get the diagnosis as early as possible. You might have a constellation of signs and symptoms which might heighten your suspicion. So, for instance, you might have a person who presents with a sleep dysfunction called REM behavior disorder, when people act out violent, intrusive dreams at night. And if such a person also, they have a reduced sense of smell, or they might have major depressive attacks, or they might have other forms of disorder such as constipation, the chances are that they have probably got Parkinson's at that stage. It is very likely that person will then transform to motor Parkinson's. And you can make a reasonable assumption in that situation to start treatment if a neuroprotective treatment is available. But the additional ethical issue we have here is that we don't have a neuroprotection treatment at this moment.
And so you are giving someone a potentially very upsetting, unnerving diagnosis, and you're saying to them, sorry, there's nothing at this stage that we can do.
Absolutely right. Having said that, the other angle to this is that these are the people who should be studied for trials which recruit to studies for neuroprotection and so on.
And if there were groups of people already identified as either being in the early stages of Parkinson's or at risk of developing it, they would be really important for researchers running clinical trials. It may be that when testing new drugs or treatment, you could expect to see a greater effect in newly diagnosed people, and it's a possible explanation for why some highly anticipated trials didn't have the clinical outcome that people had hoped for. There is a long-running project underway looking into early identification. It's called Predict PD, and it's led by Dr. Alistair Noyce, clinical senior lecturer in the Preventative Neurology Unit based at Queen Mary University of London.
currently recruiting 10,000 people via our website, predictpd.com. People answer a simple questionnaire. They get sent a smell test in the post. They complete some basic cognitive and movement tasks via on their computer keyboard. We don't tell them their risk score because we don't want to alarm people, but ultimately we try to develop a high-risk group that could go into clinical trials to try to prevent Parkinson's disease. So this is a big area of interest for us.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, do you specifically want to hear from people like me, people who've had it in the family?
Yeah, people aged 60 to 80 that may or may not have Parkinson's disease in the family, we'd like them to take part. Okay, so one of the really fun things about the PredictPD study is that after people have completed the web-based section of it, they then get sent a smell test in the post, which is a 40-item scratch-and-sniff smell test. So we've brought one along today so you could have a go.
So I'm holding this. It's a very small, multicoloured booklet, a smell ID test. And so I have to scratch off the bottom panel.
Yep.
I've got my coin.
Yep.
And then I have to decide. So it says, this odour smells most like, and I have four options, chocolate, banana, onion, or fruit punch.
That's right.
So I'm going to have a go. Like this. Try and scratch this.
That's enough.
Is that enough? It's really interesting. I feel every time I put the piece of paper to my nose, I feel as if the smell is changing slightly. I have no idea what that tells me or whether it tells me anything. Now, I'm going to go for fruit punch.
Do you want the answer?
But I'm gonna go for that. Yes.
It's onion.
Is it? No.
Should we do one more?
Should I try one more page and then and see what happens? It's quite intriguing, actually. So
test number two.
My options here are soap, fruit punch again, menthol. I love menthol and pumpkin pie. Okay. Scratch a little bit more. Is that sufficient? Now, this is much more pungent than the last one. It's much more perfumey, I would say. That's my first observation. Soap, fruit punch, menthol, pumpkin pie. The more you see, I'm going to say fruit punch. And that's making me laugh because that was what I said last time. But I am going to stick with it this time.
You'd be right.
Okay.
But it's quite hard.
It is.
And you see it's an American test because Brits would not necessarily know what pumpkin pie
That's
smells.
Interesting. Kind of fun and intriguing.
Exactly.
And people tick which of the four they think it is on every page and then post it back to you. What happens then?
So people can actually fill it in on the PredictPD website. So when they get the smell test in the post, they log back into the website and then they're presented with the answers and they click through all the smells saying what they are. And it's a nice extra to the study. We know that smell loss is really important in the early phase of Parkinson's disease and helps us to identify people earlier.
So we're talking about some of the most common pointers, depression, problems with sleep, constipation. Is someone who is going to develop Parkinson's, are they going to have all of those?
No. I think that most people that get Parkinson's disease have some degree of smell loss. So at the point of diagnosis, maybe 70% have lost their sense of smell. And later on in the disease, that figure's more like 90%. For the sleep disorders, people get excessive sleepiness during the day, but they also get a particular sleep disorder, which is called RBD. It's called REM sleep behaviour disorder, where people tend to act out vivid, action-packed dreams. And so we think about a third to a half of people with Parkinson's get RBD. And it's about the same figure for anxiety and depression. About a third to a half will have significant anxiety and depression either before or during the disease. And for constipation, it's probably in the region of 50 to 60%.
I never knew, that's a fascinating stat, I never knew that more people have the loss of smell than shake.
But
I mean, that's astonishing.
That's what I always say to people as well. You know, it's curious to me that it's not part of the diagnostic criteria. Tremor's part of the diagnostic criteria, but smell loss is more common and is unusual in general.
Yes,
I mean, there are lots of causes of tremor. There are very few causes of smell loss.
A new report by Alastair and colleagues released this October raises awareness internationally among doctors and the general public of the early symptoms of PD. And it calls on policymakers to think about and promote brain health for everyone. Back at the Brain Bank, Steve Gentleman's team receives a donation of, on average, two Parkinson's brains a week. When someone dies, there's just 24 hours to get the donated brain to the lab in London from wherever it is in the UK.
Thank you.
So one of our donors passed away yesterday somewhere in the country. So our technician now is in fact going to Colchester to collect the brain to bring it back here for us to deal with it.
And that process happens because the individual has registered, they've given their consent. So obviously your team has to be notified, sadly, immediately that they pass.
Yes. So many families will let us know within an hour of their loved one passing away, because this is something good that comes out of the whole process.
Comparing a Parkinson's brain with one that doesn't have a neurological condition allows researchers to build up greater understanding of the path of the disease.
So explain what you do next with your controlled brain.
So what we need to do is to look at the surface of the brain. We're also looking to see if there's been any shrinkage in any part of the brain, which might suggest a disease process, a degeneration. And in Parkinson's disease, it would tend to be more the frontal part of the brain. And that's probably why people with Parkinson's tend to have problems with making decisions.
And movement as well, because problems with movement is such a huge part of Parkinson's. What would a brain tell you in that regard with motor issues?
Right, so what we're going to look at for our first indication of whether there's been any motor issues is to look at a different part of the brain. And what we're looking at is the brainstem at an area called the substantia nigra, the black substance. And this is what I can show you just here. I think people are aware that Parkinson's disease can present with a tremor, a quite characteristic tremor. But actually, a large proportion of patients don't have the tremor at all. What they have is a difficulty in initiating movement, a bradykinesia, which is slow movement, or akinesia, which is no movement.
Yes, my father definitely had what you are telling me is bradykinesia. So if I had looked at my father's brain after he died, it would not have this little patch of colour in the centre that we're looking at.
That would have gone. Those cells would have died off. In someone with Parkinson's disease, all that colour has gone because those nerve cells, which sit there normally and have this pigment in, have died. And those nerve cells are the ones that help movement. They're the ones that initiate movement. Okay, here we have one of our Parkinson's donors. If we have a look at the brainstem here now, we can see here in the midbrain, in this area where we should have that black substance, that substantia nigra, it's all gone.
It's completely gone. It's a uniform colour. It's completely gone. I'm astonished. I didn't realise it literally, to the naked eye, it literally has disappeared.
Yes. We take some heart from the fact that it takes probably about 70% loss of those cells before a patient becomes symptomatic. So research can tell us which of these people are developing these changes early on, before they have symptoms. That's where we're aiming. We want a treatment that stops the disease process before a patient even starts showing symptoms. But to do that, we need to be able to identify those people at risk.
But a neuroprotective agent doesn't yet exist, something that can protect the cells that are still healthy at the time of diagnosis and so stop the disease in its tracks. Ray Chowdhury is one of the many people I've spoken to for this series who say that really is what the scientific community is aiming for.
In my view, at this moment in time, what would be a real advance is that if I develop Parkinson and if I went to my neurologist and he or she could tell me that, well, I can't cure you, but I can give you a drug that will keep you in this particular state for the next 15 years. To me, that will represent an enormous progress. We even don't have that. And really, that is what we should be focusing on. The research should really focus on how to arrest the development and progression of this condition. We can only do that when we do address not just dopamine, but the other systems, look at the different subtypes and pay attention to the non-motor symptoms. And perhaps we should be also looking at molecules or drugs which have multiple action, not just a very specific focused treatment, which really hasn't worked.
It can take more than a decade and more than $1 billion to get a drug from development to implementation. But Simon Stott argues that for Parkinson's, there's another pragmatic approach: repurposing, adapting drugs that are in use for other conditions. This route can be faster and cheaper because the medication has already gone through safety checks.
That approach has had some success with the compound called exenatide, a drug that is used for diabetes. And that has had interesting results at the phase 2 level. Folks on exenatide had a stabilization of their motor symptoms over a 48-week period. And it was only when they came off the medication that their symptoms started to get worse again. So this suggests that this drug, which is being repurposed from diabetes into Parkinson's, could be very useful for this condition. And we're about to start a phase 3 trial, a large phase 3 trial, to test that idea.
So how much do we know about why a drug that's designed for diabetes can be effective in people with Parkinson's?
So it's not effective in all people with Parkinson's, I should add. So in Parkinson's disease, it's activating specific neuroprotective pathways, biological pathways, is what we suspect.
Well, the goal of the Fox Foundation is to close. So I really look forward to that day when I get to retire. We are not here to exist forever. We want to achieve this goal and then move on.
Dr. Todd Shearer is CEO of the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. He's in charge of its research strategy and argues genetics is now a fruitful area of study. Whenever I've told researchers that two close members of my family had the disease, they try to reassure me that only about 5% of cases are believed to have a genetic link. But Todd says investigation in this field brings wider benefits.
There's a small population of people that may carry some of these very specific genes that lead to Parkinson's. So in one case, you now can view Parkinson's as a variability or varied disease with different causes. So in one case, it may be due to a genetic cause. In another case of Parkinson's, that person may not have any genetic involvement. So you can start to now segment the disease based on the underlying biology. And importantly, then look for more personalized treatments. So treatments that are targeting the biology that's happening in those individuals.
This strengthens the idea that Parkinson's isn't a single disease, rather a collection of conditions. Most genetic studies so far have been based on Western populations, so the Fox Foundation is launching a large global study to expand research into Africa, East Asia, India, and Latin America.
At this point, there's not really been any discoveries that indicate that there are different genetic contributors in different populations across the world. But we have had some evidence where some genetic findings can be enriched in certain ethnic or racial populations. So, for example, some of the genes that have been found in Parkinson's, one that's called LRRK2 and one that's called GBA, are enriched in people of Ashkenazi Jewish or North African Berber descent, meaning that a higher percentage of patients with that background may have one of these mutations. So you can really gain great insight by diversifying the population of people that are involved in research and studied so that we could make great inroads. And importantly, it helps all individuals because, for example, in the case I just mentioned with LRRK2, those trials that are now undergoing for LRRK2 are looking to test the therapy not only in individuals with LRRK2 mutations, but all Parkinson's patients. So the genetics becomes kind of a starting point for this research and can expand to the entire population. We have a very robust pipeline of new treatments that are being tested. And many of these treatments have now moved into clinical testing up through actually testing them in Parkinson's patients. So we haven't gotten all the way across the goal line yet, but we have a really robust clinical pipeline now, over a dozen clinical trials that are ongoing, really targeting this new biology with great new potential. And what's most exciting, again, is that these are targeting the underlying disease process. Parkinson's being a progressive disease, one of our main goals is to try to slow that process down. And this is the great potential of some of these genetic-based therapies.
So Todd Shearer is optimistic, though as someone who's seen this disease at close quarters, I can't help feeling that progress is slow because Parkinson's is so complicated. More than 200 years since Dr. James Parkinson observed what he termed the shaking palsy in people in the East End of London, families like mine are still hoping for that breakthrough drug that will at least slow or even halt its progress. Equally, I have to take heart that there is a huge amount of research currently underway. I want to leave the final word to two of the many remarkable people I've met while making this series, who are living with the condition, Mariette Rebane and Paul Mayhew Archer.
We've now made mobile phones, which are so powerful they contain all the computerization that could send somebody to the moon. And yet, we can't find some way of sending a message from my brain to my mouth. And it's inches. So I can't help feeling that we ought to be able to find some sort of cure. I think apparently we're getting closer to halting the process. And so the more that we know about all the different symptoms, the more chance there is that people will say, oh my God, my voice seems to be getting weaker, or my handwriting seems to be getting smaller. Maybe it's Parkinson's.
I'm dependent on medication. A few weeks ago, I forgot one of my daily doses, and I've forgotten that I forgot, so that's the worst. And I thought in the evening, God, it's really bad news, this Parkinson's. I can't walk. I'm like a hobbit. And then I thought back, I forgot one of my doses. So...
And that's how much difference it makes.
That's why I think we should all be really grateful to researchers constantly looking for better treatments. I don't think I'm the one to say either care or cure, and care means treatment, cure means modification. It's an impossible question for any patient to answer. I always say, if now somebody came in with a little box nicely wrapped up and it said cure on it, and we were sitting here with 100 people of Parkinson's, and one box of cure would come in, what will we do? Will the people who focus on treatment say, oh, no, I don't, no, it's not for me because I don't believe in a cure? No, we will all run like crazy to get this little box which says cure. So it's an impossible question.
You can hear all three episodes of The Truth About Parkinson's on the BBC website. I'm Jane Hill. The producer was Geraldine Fitzgerald.